Hey, Brett here, and I want to tell you about our exciting new sponsor, Afterlife.com. If you're like me, you're planning to go to heaven, but you're also a little leery of all the surprises that traveling to a new place can bring, am I right? That's why you should go to Afterlife.com, the 1990s-style flash-animated website which simulates the experience of ascending to heaven after the apocalypse. Watch with delight as all the sinners you used to know burn below in a pit of hell, while you ascend into the clouds amidst beautiful animated GIFs and clip art. That's afterlife.com. So in preparation for your journey to the light, don't leave yourself in the dark. Warning, animation may cause seizures.
1 penny, 2 penny, 3 pennies, 4 pennies, 5 pennies make a...
nickel.
Hi, everyone. Do you like ads? Of course you don't. They're stupid. And even though School Sucks is a project that requires a lot of time and money, we're working hard to keep the show ad-free. You can help us by going to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and become a monthly subscriber. You'll get access to hundreds of hours of additional content, and it really, really helps the show. If enough people do it, it's like having sponsors.
Let's go faster!
Thank you.
1 penny, 2 pennies, 3 pennies, 4 pennies, 5 pennies make a...
nickel!
6 pennies, 7 pennies, 8 pennies, 9 pennies, 10 pennies make a...
dime!
2 dimes and a nickel make a...
quarter! And...
hey, everybody. Today is May 16th. First of all, real quick introduction, okay? If you've been listening for a while, welcome back. Thanks for coming back. But I also wanted to do just an orientation, a brief orientation for anybody new who might be joining us. Dan Carlin is the guest today, and I will certainly ask him to, you know, tweet this, share this, maybe repost this, and that might bring in some new people. So if you are one of those people, first of all, welcome, and I want to assure you, we do have some stuff in common. I'm a big fan of Dan Carlin as well. But just a little explanation of what this is and what we do. School Sucks Project is first and foremost a podcast, but also a call-in show, a YouTube channel, and a web community. We promote real learner-driven education, and we try to deconstruct what we consider to be harmful indoctrination. So we discuss learning strategies, self-education, critical thinking, history, politics, peaceful parenting, personal growth, and better communication strategies. You can find us on the web at schoolsucksproject.com. You can register an account. You can participate in our forums. You can suggest show topics, and you can access years of archives. If you enjoy history, I would recommend our American Way series, which explores the, in my opinion, frightening parallels between the prevailing ideologies and societal norms in the Third Reich with the present-day United States. I look forward to your outrage on that. I would also recommend our Logic Saves Lives podcast series. This will hopefully provide people with a chance to sharpen their debate skills and strengthen their intellectual self-defense while poking a little bit of fun at the most ridiculous of conspiracy theories and the mainstream media and some of academia. And there's a lot of good guests and a lot of good conversations in that, so I hope you'll check out that as well. I will warn you that you might find some of the positions expressed on this show, even though I believe they are very, very well researched, to be frustrating, to be challenging, in some cases infuriating. But I hope you'll give us a chance, at least comb through our archives, see if anything piques your interest. The site again, schoolsucksproject.com. And if you are a regular participant, I really want to generate more conversation about this show. So we are doing a live one tonight, 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can watch us at schoolsucksproject.com/live. So if something, you know, angers you about what happens in the next 90 minutes in my conversation with Dan Carlin, or, you know, gets you thinking about something, please consider giving us a call tonight, 843-JOIN-SSP, or Skype in School Sucks Live and share your thoughts. Help create another show. So that's it. Big deal for me. Huge Dan Carlin fan. You'll hear me talk about this in the show, but he was a big influence on me early on. That was around 2006. And in the years that followed, Dan and I certainly took some divergent paths on certain issues. But that's great. That generates a conversation, more of the conversations that I want to have on this show. So this was terrific. I look forward to having Dan back. And hey, everyone, thanks for listening. I hope you continue to listen. I'm thinking in an upcoming show, I am probably going to shoot that rooster that you can kind of hear in the background with a crossbow and flaming arrows. You know, like it's 10 a.m. We're all awake, rooster. Some of us are trying to record a podcast. All right. Thanks, everyone. More stuff coming soon. Take care. My guest today is Dan Carlin. He is the host of the politics and current events show Common Sense, as well as Hardcore History, which, oh, Dan, how do we explain Hardcore History?
I'm not sure either. It's sort of like a Twilight Zone meets history meets dramatic old-time radio program, sort of.
Well, if you haven't heard it, if people haven't heard it, it is truly an amazing podcast. And interesting thing about Dan, he was one of the first podcasters, these two podcasts, both of them, at about the same time, I would say around 2006, that I got into listening to. I think Common Sense was first, and then Hardcore History. And I consider Dan to be very, very influential. I really liked his style. In fact, you know, when the people who listen to School Sucks, when you hear me go, now some of you are saying, Brett, I stole that from Dan Carlin. I just realized that, Dan.
Okay. Well, listen, as the great James Burke, who did the Connection series, once told me, when it comes to stealing things, he said, one of his mentors said, young man, where do you think ideas come from?
Right.
And so I think we all do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So all that being said, the shows have been around for a while. And I know that you've talked about a career, a pretty lengthy career that you had in what is today fit by the retronym, the mainstream media. Now that we have all of this alternative media, you were in television broadcasting and you also were a radio talk show host.
Yes, for quite a long time.
So how did you ultimately leave that profession and transition into podcasting?
I think it probably stems from how poor a fit I was for the so-called mainstream media. I was a history major in college, and they never tell you what to do with history when you graduate with that. And somehow I got into the news business right out of college, worked for some news television news stations in Los Angeles, and sort of for lack of a better idea, and I think a lot of our lives move forward sometimes for lack of a better idea, I sent out some resume tapes of us, me, doing stories. I mean, I was working on the assignment desk. Part of my job in L.A. was to find stories for reporters to cover and organize crews to get to events and those kind of things. And I would have reporters that weren't a whole lot older than I was say, what are you doing to get out of here? And I was in Los Angeles. I didn't want to get out of there. I mean, I thought I was fine. And they said, no, you're going to die here if you don't do something to get out. So send out these resume tapes and sort of to just shut them up. So I had something to tell them when they came in and hassled me every morning. I sent out these tapes, and I didn't think there was a real big risk of getting a job as a reporter because I knew a lot of people who were sending out resume tape after resume tape after resume tape, and no one was getting hired. So I thought, okay, I'll just do this to shut up these people who are trying to help me against my will. And lo and behold, I got hired really quickly, and then you sort of have to do something about that. And ended up coming up to Oregon for a television reporter job. And found out that TV reporting and yours truly were not very suited for each other. First of all, I am way too long-winded for television reporting. Mm. And second of all, I am just the wrong guy to go have, you know, cover a bunch of, you know, usually most television reporters, especially early on in their careers, mix what you would call real news stories with knife show stories and the local, you know, cute story for a kicker story on the news and all the, I was just so terrible at all those kind of things. And so I became pretty dissatisfied with news quickly. And then someone offered me a chance to get into talk radio. Long story short, I get into talk radio only to find out I am just as poorly suited to that as I was in television news. I'm neither a conservative nor a liberal. The era that I started in talk radio was an era where conservatives dominated it. And so you would have this whole lineup on the radio station where I work, where it's conservative host, and then me, and then another conservative host. I was like the out of place person in the day part. I was apparently good enough to keep the job, but I found myself at odds a lot of the time with my own audience. And so you'd have this really interesting show, I think, where the host and the audience didn't really even get along. And so I would do these shows yelling at my audience saying, you know, what are you people prepared to do to create positive change? And one day this guy calls me up and says, if you'll go to dinner with me, I'll tell you what I'm prepared to do to create positive change. Okay, so I go to dinner with the guy. He shows up. He's got hair down to his waist. He's a computer genius. And long story short, he's got this idea, and it's like 1996 or something, to put me on the internet. Now, there wasn't even protocols to put someone like me broadcasting on the internet back then, but to him, that was part of the challenge. He was going to help invent the tools to broadcast on the internet, and I was going to be the guinea pig and the payoff and everything else. So long story short, we ended up working together, and after a couple more different changes, I was perfectly positioned when iTunes came out to jump into the realm of podcasting when it was a little like the Oklahoma land rush, and there wasn't a whole lot of people squatting on the free property at the time. And then when everybody else showed up, there I was with my little plot of land trying to defend it from new squatters. And so that's kind of how the whole thing happened.
Now, when you were on the radio, would you describe what you were trying to do as something similar to what Common Sense is like right up to today?
Yes. If you take as a matter of fact, it's almost the same thing. If you take out the fact that I had phone calls and the show was 3 hours long, 5 days a week, which, you know, that's one of the things I'm really happy that I don't have to worry about anymore, because it's the same problem you see, I think, on some of these 24-hour news stations where they have so much time to fill that you're really sometimes giving attention to things that don't deserve it or that you're not even that interested in, but you have 3 hours a day, 5 days a week to fill. And that and the fact that, you know, when I was in talk radio, I got into talk radio relatively young. I was about 26 or 27 when I had a show. And the average, I mean, the low age of the listeners in talk radio's demographics are like 35 years old. Those are the kids listening to talk radio. And so I'm younger than the whole audience and just screaming and yelling at them, and they don't like me much. And it was a really interesting dynamic. And I managed to keep doing that job on and off for like 12 years, but it was not exactly satisfying. And you'd get off the air just fuming and kicking things. But yeah, it sounded a lot like Common Sense, my podcast, does today. The only thing I can say in my favor is that events have moved more towards the stuff I was talking about back then. And so things that looked crazy to my listening audience in 1997 or 1998 look a heck of a lot more reasonable and rational and reflective of the times we live in now. So I kind of, not to toot my own horn here, but I kind of saw some of the developments in politics that were heading our way. Mm. And now that they're here, I get a lot less argument from the listeners about, you know, what I'm talking about.
Let me ask you this question. I don't see being a podcaster as a way to get into talk radio. In fact, I think that's a terrible idea. But I do sometimes have this fantasy of my show just showing up on a progressive station or a conservative station. And all of these people, I think that would just be so invigorating. And then just to have the phone start ringing. I mean, we do a call-in show, but, you know, with this niche stuff, with this narrow casting stuff, it seems like you do wind up preaching to the choir more than you would have if you had that wider audience. And I'm, you know, I do like being able, I think we can be more productive as a unit, as a group, pushing a consistent message to a reliable audience. But sometimes I miss that lack of the debate that's possible with a medium like talk radio. So were you ever excited and energized by that, or because of the typical, you know, not to insult anybody, but the typical talk radio, conservative talk radio listener, did you just find that to be too frustrating?
Well, let me deal with the first part you brought up.
Sure.
First about the idea of being able to deal with people of different political beliefs and all that. Talk radio isn't organized that way. It wasn't organized that way when liberals tried to create their own network, and it isn't organized that way with conservatives. You essentially get people of one stripe listening.
Right.
And that's why so many of these talk radio programs have special listener lines devoted to people who may disagree with them, because the whole echo chamber effect is not fun listening in talk radio. Even the audience wants to hear, you know, the people from the other side call in so the host can engage them. So you don't get that perhaps as much as you think you might. It's like, you know, how many conservatives are actually watching MSNBC, you know, and giving feedback? So I think when you divide the audiences into political segments, that's what tends to listen. So everybody hated me, though, because I wasn't a conservative. And I certainly was making even the station managers angry, because I just don't believe in knee-jerk, easy answers to things. And so I would bring up what I think is pretty standard in podcasting, but sort of complex, gray area kind of ideas. And in talk radio, they hate that. Or they did when I was there anyway. They want heat, as they used to call it. They want easy to understand controversy. They want lowest common denominator stuff, because the perception is you can engage more people if you don't, you know, self-select based on intelligence and how well-informed people are and all that kind of stuff. As far as the idea of doing – see, this is – I'm glad you brought up the idea of sort of doing a podcast as a stepping stone to a mainstream media job, because I have to tell people all the time that that's not what I'm doing.
Right.
My mainstream media job got me the podcasting job, is the way I look at it. And I'm in contact with a couple of the other, you know, big podcasters, and we all agree – we're never giving this up ever. This is, I mean, we are unfireable. As long as we continue to put out good content, nobody can fire us. Any project that we do on the outside simply helps us grow this audience more. You know, you can do it out of your house. You can make up all the rules as you go along. I mean, to me, this is a talk radio show host's dream come true. Ultimate creativity, no consultants. I mean, the radio consultants are nightmares to deal with. And, you know, and when I started in radio, there was a law that said a radio company could only own, you know, a handful of radio stations, and you would work in the radio station where the owner was. Now, the last station I worked at owned 1,000 radio stations, which means, you know, every person in there is simply a cog in a large machine. Now I have my own company. I run it myself. Nobody tells me what to do. And I mean, podcasting is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me career-wise.
Oh, yeah. And I think I've certainly understood for some time that the medium of talk radio or even cable news is not doesn't cater to people who are seeking new information. It is something people go to those things because they want to feed their confirmation bias more than anything else.
And to back up what you were saying kind of about getting on traditional radio outlets, there are a lot of the big radio players right now, as part of the applications that they, you know, offer for people's phones and stuff, are reaching out to podcasters for content right now. So this convergence between what you and what I and what the other podcasters do and what the so-called mainstream media does is all coming together. I mean, the new cars that everybody's going to buy are going to have these places where you just slip your phone in. And it's as easy to get what we do as it is to turn on the radio. I read a report the other day that says cars in the very near future may be built without radios.
Yeah.
So already, you know, this convergence that turns you into the same thing all these, you know, national radio hosts are, is underway right now.
Well, see, in my fantasy, Dan, I think I did introduce it as a fantasy. I just kind of like break into the broadcast like V for Vendetta style in the middle of the Ed Schultz show or the Hannity show, and people just have to deal with that. The more combative side of me.
Well, I see that. That's sort of like a pirate radio kind of idea. I can appreciate that.
Sure. So we were on the we're doing this show on a radio network called LRN that was ultimately wound up on satellite radio. And I just remember doing that show. I mean, I ultimately walked away from it because I didn't like the format and having to, you know, translate a break every 10 minutes into something that seemed like a pretty smooth podcast. So I did give it up. But there was that excitement when I knew the show was going out that somebody who was listening to XM could tune in with a totally different perspective and call in, and we could have this interesting debate. I really just felt like people who come from a different position really aren't interested in talking to people who are coming from where I am. And I think that's unfortunate. I don't want to shame people for what they believe. I don't want to be combative. But I do want to do something else than just preaching to the choir. And it seems like, especially with your Common Sense show, you have a broad audience that pulls from a lot of different political ideologies.
Yes. And I just wanted to quickly say that when you mentioned mandatory breaks and all the stuff that goes along with traditional radio broadcasting, we couldn't even do our hardcore history show in that sort of medium. I mean, to me, podcasting provides a completely blank creative slate for us. And with hardcore history, you have to have this really unbroken time period to sort of drag people into a different mental place. If we had to take breaks that took them back to reality, I don't think it would work. And so, again, I think that the creative constraints that are put on you by having to fit into these scheduling boxes and these formatting boxes, as you said, kind of inhibit your creative ability. To get what you just said, the Common Sense thing, well, I feel like we're finally, I mean, I've been doing this a long time now, but I mean, with Common Sense, we're finally able to attract the sort of audience where my style works. You know, it's like I said at the beginning of this talk that I really didn't fit in all these other areas. And I feel like, you know, I'm the toy on the who finally finds the island of lost toys. I mean, I finally found the place where not being an ideologue and not being in some political box is rewarded instead of being punished. And I feel like it takes a while to reach a critical mass because people are really conditioned to believe that you're hiding your real political persuasion. I remember we went on the Young Turks show. I was a guest there once, and somebody had sold them on the idea that here was this guy who didn't fit into the major parties. And the host couldn't believe that. And so my entire visit there consisted of him trying to unmask what I really was. And I find, you know, to me, that's just a sign, and everybody is forgiven for that because we're all sort of conditioned to think that that's how people are. You really are this or you really are that, but you think maybe you found this way to hide it to, you know, appear more reasonable or be a stealth person where I'm really trying to push a conservative or liberal agenda on you, but I'm sneaking it towards you under this cover of, you know, not being a liberal or not being a conservative. To me, too, the fact that all of a sudden I was able to go from a medium in talk radio where the average age of the listener is like 54, 55 years old, and the young ones are in their mid-30s, to a medium on the internet where all of a sudden I got college kids listening, you know? Mm-hmm. I've got some high school kids listening. The median age is much more in like the mid to late 20s. That's a group of people that are much less conditioned by the old-fashioned political, you know, to steal a word from psychology 101, the political totems that we were all raised with. And so, you know, finally, I have an opportunity to reach the kind of people that weren't listening to talk radio in those days. So I was kind of made for this medium. For me, this was like finally finding the one place where I fit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I really feel the same way. And I honestly, I couldn't imagine my show really in a much different format. I think that was one of the things we didn't like about radio is that you couldn't get into the rhythm with that. But turning more towards process, on my show, we talk a lot about better learning, but also better doing. And you've been very, very successful with this history show, which is really, from the ones I've heard, and I've heard quite a few of them, a monumental undertaking to explore some of these topics from the depth and from different angles, like angles people wouldn't think to look at these things from. So I wanted to ask you, as a, first of all, a fellow podcaster, but maybe some tips for other people, what is your process for planning, for getting organized, and ultimately delivering on those productions?
First of all, I wish I could take credit for having this grand vision that these shows have become, but it wasn't my idea. My mother-in-law, of all people, was the one that came up with the idea to do a history podcast because I have a degree in history, and this is the sort of stuff that intrigues me. I've always included history as part of sort of the backdrop of our political shows. But, you know, we'll be having dinner with the family and I'm ranting and railing about all these different historical ideas. And one day, maybe just to get me to shut up, my mother-in-law said, well, why don't you do a podcast about this? And I remember saying, because I'm not qualified. And I started to explain to her, you know, what you need to have as an educational resume to be a historian, you know, really needing a doctorate, all those kind of things. And she said to me, wait a minute, I don't understand. You have to have a doctorate to tell stories? And I thought, that's actually a really good point. And some of the historians from the old days were nothing more than fans of history like I am. H.G. Wells wrote histories. He was unqualified by modern standards. All the great old Greek historians, Roman historians, none of those people, Gibbon, none of those people have degrees, advanced degrees in history. And so I thought, well, listen, as long as I'm not making pronouncements like I'm a historian, which I don't do, and I make it very clear on the program that I'm not a historian. I have a degree, but it's not an advanced degree in history. I can tell these stories. But originally, the stories were supposed to be for people just like me. I was going to do a show for the kind of people that used to congregate in the break rooms, you know, where history majors used to hang out in college, and you'd have these weird discussions that was really for history geeks. And so if you listen to the first history show we ever did, it's not a show for people who don't know the stories already. It assumes a certain amount of knowledge on your part. And you'll be able to relate to this very well. But like any creative piece of episodic content, look at TV series out there, for example, it develops a life of its own after you start it. And especially for the first several episodes, it's a piece that's starting to go in a direction maybe that your creativity never envisioned. Go watch a show like Seinfeld, I always say, and look at how different the first five or six episodes are from what it eventually becomes. You know, the artists have an idea on paper, they throw it out there, and then it begins to evolve in its own fashion, which is what happened with the history show, and it began to get longer. It began to fill in knowledge. I was getting people who were liking it who had no interest in history at all, which started to make you think, okay, now I have to actually explain something about these events. I can't assume people already know the info. So we would start to give more background, and then that became dramatic and fun. And all of a sudden, we went from the first show that was like 15 minutes to the show I just finished, which was 4 hours.
Yeah.
I don't know anybody else who does four-hour podcasts, and I don't choose to do them. It just turns out it takes that long to tell the story. But again, so we're in territory here that was never part of my plan, that I never envisioned. And so when you say, what's the process for doing them? Well, we just sort of muddle through, I guess is the best way to put it. And sometimes, you know, I must be the worst picker of topics in the whole world, because when I pick them, they always look, oh, I can do this in an hour and a half. And it never works out that way. Well, but that's how it happens, sort of by mistake.
Yeah, in a related story, I mean, I set out to do this in 2009. It kind of had its genesis in a treatment that I wanted to do. It's a documentary film. And I said, well, I should just get these ideas out there, and maybe that would draw interest, or at the very least, I'm communicating what I think I've learned from my experience in education over the course of a decade. Maybe it would take 10 hours to do this. Well, this is going to be episode like 216, 217. And you're right. It turned into something else. And I also think the satisfaction that I got from it, and once people started to buy into it, and there was listeners, and there was a community built around it, it became something else. So, you know, I do encourage people to, if they feel like they have these ideas, to try and put them on paper or put them into the documentary film medium, or why not start a podcast? You never know what it's going to become. The show was much, much different when I started doing it. And I'm really happy with its evolution, as I'm guessing you are with Hardcore History. The first episode I ever heard was like 15 minutes, right?
Yeah, that was the first one. You heard the pilot. Well, and I even tell my wife, I married another broadcaster in radio, and I keep telling her, I said, you know, we have the studio, we have the microphone, I'm all set up. You need to do a podcast too. And so down the road, maybe I can convince her to do one as well. Because I do feel like, as you said, once people start giving you feedback, once you start to, I mean, I think a light goes on eventually after you've done it for a while, when you realize the creative freedom that allows you. I mean, I to sort of back up, I used to do improv comedy a long time ago. And what's amazing about improv comedy that I learned was that it's like a muscle in your brain. Once you start doing it and once you're under pressure to be funny on a regular basis, you start noticing more funny things around you. And it starts, you know, once you develop that muscle a little, it becomes easier to develop it more. And I feel like podcasting and creativity is very similar. Once you start looking for topics for your show, once you get good at that, you start seeing them everywhere. My wife says, "What will I talk about?" And I say, once you start doing it and once it evolves into something really kind of clear, you'll find stuff all over the place. That little part of your brain will begin to get a workout and it just kind of takes care of itself. Like you said, you're what, a couple hundred shows into it?
Yeah.
Somehow you found the topics and you found the ability to make it sustainable and interesting for your audience and for yourself.
Well, that gets us to what I actually wanted to talk to you about in the history area. I did this podcast trying to draw some parallels between the direction that the United States is heading and this very, very controversial topic, this dreaded question about the Nazis. Could that happen here? And is it happening here? And I know this is something that you covered on Hardcore History. I did it once in a podcast. I later turned it into a video. The video got like 100,000 views, but a lot of people were very critical of it. They said it was an oversimplification. So then it became another 5 hours of podcasts that elaborated on what the 8-minute video covered. And this was about a year ago. And since then, I've really kind of questioned. I stand by most of what I said, but I think the presentation made it seemingly entirely about the trends and forces of history, the prevailing political ideologies, the undercurrent of philosophy that was responsible for what ultimately happened in the middle of the 20th century in Europe. But I know on Hardcore History, you talk more about the accidents, the wild cards. One of the shows I just listened to was History Under the Influence, where you're like, hey, maybe these people were drunk. You know, I think that's an important question, but it might be smaller things than these huge trends and forces that drive history. And I think I overlooked a lot of that stuff.
Well, it depends on which aspect you want me to speak upon. Sure. On the idea of kind of the drivers in history, I'm a firm believer that if you go back and you read the stuff that, you know, basically what happens with history over time is historians over the ages have tried to, as humans do, compartmentalize what history means. And does it, you know, this is how you get theories like the great man theory of history and the trends and forces theories of history. And they try to find templates and easy to understand, at least for historians, boxes that this stuff can all be classified into. More modern day historical thinkers are starting to really synthesize those kinds of ideas, right, and realize that, I mean, some of them even talk about it in a chaos theory kind of sense, because if it becomes complicated and there's enough interplay, it almost seems like chaos, because obviously you're going to have things like trends and forces involved. I mean, take something like the Great Depression and how that can begin to set up all sorts of forces that push developments and create incentives and disincentives that drive human beings to do relatively predictable things. But then you throw people into the equation, because after all, the history of humanity involves this critical wild card, people, and they're involved. And it's very easy to turn around and say, yes, the Great Depression did A, but if you don't have this particular kind of individual acting on what the trends and forces have made possible, do you really get B? Nowadays, I think the theories that make the most sense, and I think I'm pretty much in line with mainstream historical thought on this, is that it's an interplay of all these different things working together. Great people who make decisions that might not otherwise be made, historical forces and trends that set up the conditions where those kinds of things can happen and sort of drive general momentum in a specific direction, and things that just happen that are wild cards. People just die sometimes. Or like you said, that we talked about in History Under the Influence, Napoleon takes some opium-type preparation the night before the Battle of Waterloo so that his stomach pain is tolerable so he can sleep. And he wakes up groggy and makes the sort of mistakes a guy like Napoleon never makes, and boom, history goes in a direction it otherwise wouldn't have gone in. I think it's the complex interplay of a bunch of different things that, as I said, that might be equivalent to like random chaos when you add them all together, that helps explain why things turn out the way they do. As far as this idea of the Nazis and can we go there and all that kind of stuff, to me, my own opinion is that I think we humans are too focused on looking at past systems when we try to determine where things are going, and forget that, you know, before there was fascism or Nazism and those kind of things, there was something else. And that those things were departures and to some degree newfound developments, or they built upon systems that were like them enough so that they were novel. We could have something completely new.
Right.
And people don't figure on that because you can't imagine what completely new means. I had a history professor once. He taught a international relations, history of international relations. And he was a very old guy when I was learning from him. So this was probably 1983, 1984. He was probably 78, 79 years old, and he was German. And he'd lived through the Second World War. He'd lived through Nazism. And he used to say, he tried to impress upon Americans that when or if something like that ever came to the United States, that it wouldn't be what we're looking for. We're looking for jackboots. We're looking for Hitler salutes. We're looking for Hitlers. And he pointed out that these kinds of things tie themselves up to the specific myths and loves of the culture that they're attaching themselves to. We won't have German fascism if it ever comes to this country. We will have apple pie, baseball, you know, American versions of this, and it will seem completely American and normal to us, because if you study the way these forces and movements in other countries have been, that's how they appear to those people. Nazism appeared very German. It was tied into old German mythology and myths and ideas. Absolutely, just like, yeah. Italian fascism tied itself to Italian mythology and Rome and all these kinds of things. That's how it touches the nationalism soul of people. And so I think if you're looking for that kind of a Nazi kind of occurrence in the United States, you're not going to see it, because it would be like importing another system's myths and ideas and approaches. Whatever this country is going to morph into, it's going to be very John Wayne. It's going to be very the word God will be included somehow. It might not be Christian, but it'll be the same kind of God you hear at the end of the State of the Union speeches. It'll be very American, and it will seem completely natural to a lot of Americans. It'll seem patriotic.
Yeah.
And that's how these things work.
And I think when that question comes up of could it happen here, and is it happening here? Well, it is a very nebulous word. I mean, are we talking about fascism? Are we talking about the Holocaust? Of course, what went down in Germany in the 30s and the 40s in the enlightened Western world could never happen again, because the world has already seen it. And I think that if it was that explicit, there would be these telltale signs. Like, no one could, no matter how likable they were as a leader of a Western country, they couldn't say, all right, everyone, great idea. We're going to put people on trains. We're going to send them to camps. That just wouldn't go over. But I think what a lot of libertarians, especially those who are more history minded, have tried to point out, really kind of picking up on the trends in the United States, I would say really since September 11th, is that there are going to be ominous parallels, as Leonard Peikoff called it in his book, between the two. And they will be subtle, and everything will feel very natural. There will be a natural progression. But if you have your ear to the ground, there will be clues that it's coming.
Well, and I think, again, to get into the trends and forces side of this, I always try to imagine other ways things could have played out. I mean, imagine that September 11th, you brought it up, happens. Mm-hmm. How many different potential responses does the political class in this country really have? The trends and forces historians of 50 years ago would have tried to make the case that there's an extremely narrow number of options for the political class. Now, do we have to invade a country like Iraq that probably has little to do with the September 11th or nothing to do with the September 11th attacks? No, that might be able to be, you know, you might be able to tie that to the specific administration, the advisors around the president at the time and all that. But we're going to attack somebody and we're going to be scared and we're going to want mechanisms to be put into place to make sure that such an attack doesn't happen again. In other words, you know, the specifics might change, but the general direction of where things were heading, we're going to be towards legislating while in fear, worry about protecting our population, which is probably the right response, and to tend to overreact. And then see, in a system like ours, once you start a dynamic rolling, take security as a perfect example, you begin to create, and I know you understand this already, you begin to create winners in a system like that. For example, let's say you are a company that makes airport scanners and you are going to see a huge increase in your business because now we're much more concerned about airport security. So what's going to happen if all of a sudden 5, 10, 15 years from now, we decide we're not as worried about terrorists anymore and we want to back things down a little bit and return to what they used to call around the era of the First World War, normalcy? Well, all of a sudden that's bad for you.
Yeah.
You're going to probably lobby politicians to remain vigilant, might be a good way a political person would put it, to keep things good for your business. In other words, we have a system where everybody pursues their own individual interest. That's free enterprise. It goes back to many libertarian ideas. But the problem is you create a dynamic where it's always very difficult for us to change the road we're on because people have, you know, bent all of their ideas and priorities and everything to profit and do well from the way things are. A 9/11 is a classic historical 90-degree right turn, something that no one deliberately in our country set out to do, and that changes the way things are, and then everybody sort of recalibrates how they're doing things so that they can profit and thrive in the new reality. So what we've kind of done is very predictable after 9/11. The problem is that we've reset our course, as you mentioned, in a direction that has an ultimate destination that none of us wants to go to, not even the guy making, you know, the security screening stuff for the airport. And yet it's very difficult with the political dynamic the way it is for us to change course without some other, you know, unforeseeable event that does it for us.
Okay, well, we mentioned the people who certainly benefit from this kind of condition. So let me, that raises an interesting question. I don't know, I don't think I've ever heard you weigh in on this. We talked about the great man theory of history and the trends and forces theory of history. And this is not an official theory of history, but what about more of the behind the scenes theory of history, that there's people in power or people who have access to power, you never really see their faces or learn their names, and they are not in the way of like a Illuminati or unilateral organized cabal kind of way. But, you know, I'm talking about things like the impact of intellectuals, Project for a New American Century, Colonel Edward House, central banks, those kinds of things. Do you see those as really, really significant factors in driving the direction of, you know, politics and international relations?
Well, I think you have to be careful because it's easy to talk about the effect that powerful entities have on the direction a country goes, which is undeniable, and then decide that those powerful entities are in league with each other. And that creates an almost conspiratorial idea that suggests that everything is moving in the directions that shadowy forces want them to go. I'm certainly, and I think history backs this up a million times over, certain that there are powerful entities that impact the decision-making of governments, not just in our country, but around the world, in all kinds of significant ways. I mean, the International Monetary Fund does that.
Sure.
But I'm also a believer that there's no sort of agreed-upon outcome, and that sometimes these very powerful forces are balanced by other very powerful forces that want to see different outcomes. So instead of there being an Illuminati or a Bilderbergers or anything like that, you'd have to imagine that there was an Illuminati on one side and a Bilderberger on the other side, and they want different outcomes. So yes, I do believe that these powerful entities with lots of money and authority, whose membership sometimes includes a lot of these people who happen to make policy and run important businesses and organizations, that they do. They meet, they work together, they agree on broad ideas, but they're counterbalanced by other things. And I think in a society like ours, counterbalancing interests is supposed to be part of the way things work. The danger in the future could perhaps be seen as the same sort of danger you see when companies start gobbling up their competition and begin to be monopolistic. What happens if these counterbalancing interests in society begin to agree on things and become somewhat monopolistic in outlook? I would make the case to you, perhaps, that there are some political issues where you might be able to make the case that that's happening. Take, for example, the idea of the United States' role in the world. Mm-hmm. I just did a Common Sense show where we brought up the idea, which we've brought up many times before, of the United States as the global policeman of the world. This idea is something that used to have all sorts of counterbalancing interests on the other side. But in the same way we talked about how the security interests and all these people in a post 9/11 world help to keep things on the path they're on because this is how they prosper. This country, since the end of the Second World War, when we really found ourselves in this position, is now geared towards being the policeman of the world. I'm not sure without something the equivalent of a 9/11 style 90 degree turn that we could get off this rail we're on. It is almost like a train on a train track. And once you're on it, it takes a derailment to get us off. There are no major counterbalancing forces in our country pushing against the idea that the U.S. should be, for lack of a better word, were the global policeman. So without those, it is a little bit like you've got a monopoly of forces pushing in one direction, but they're not the same force. So again, it's like if you're going to think you have an Illuminati and you're going to think you have a Bilderbergers, you have to imagine those things in general on opposite sides of issues. There are a few, though, where there's broad agreement. And I think when you find that, it becomes very difficult to find any major outlets that think differently. Can you really think of any major outlets that are, you know, air quotes here, credible, pushing for any alternative to the United States as the global policeman of the world?
No, it's not even discussed. And
it's not even considered to be reputable kind of thinking.
No, absolutely right. So yeah. All that being said, wouldn't that be the greatest trick to pull then when you're talking about the counterbalancing forces to present the people with the illusion of counterbalancing forces as they do with the sort of Republicans and Democrats, where, yeah, a lot of people were extremely disappointed in what happened once Obama was elected and they thought there would be all of this change in that respect, where when he ran for president was talking about change. This is, I think, what a lot of people thought he was talking about, is dealing with this problem with the Bush foreign policy. And to see that he only accelerated a lot of these things, I think that maybe showed that there wasn't that much of a choice. Now, maybe you have more perspective than I do. You feel like there was a time when the choice between the two sides, or at least in this example, in this choice that we get in America between the right and the left, do you feel like there was a time when that was more real than it is today?
That's a significant question. let's just say that the situation has become worse. The two parties tend to agree that they want there to be just two credible parties. They put in all sorts of roadblocks and inhibitions to participation from other parties and entities. They make it very difficult. They're all for third parties if they think it's going to hurt the other side. But in general, the ballot access laws, the rules that govern who get to be and who don't get to be in political debates, all these things are almost two-party conspiracies to prevent ideas outside the two-party mainstream from getting significant play. And what's interesting is you can see these ideas actually get some play when you watch the primaries. Both Democrats and Republicans are able to get what you could call, I guess, for lack of a better word, everyone will know what we mean, fringe candidates up in the primaries. Take a Ron Paul as a wonderful example, but there are tons. You could take a Mike Gravel if you want to find a Democratic equivalent. Mm-hmm. These guys get up there and push some of the ideas that a lot of Americans could agree with. I mean, a Mike Gravel or a Ron Paul would get up there and say the U.S. shouldn't be the policeman of the world. But then they will mix that idea with a bunch of things that people cannot stomach at all, stuff that appear to be totally off the deep end. So you never get people that appear to be electable pushing ideas that, well, are actually very rational ideas, ideas that there might be limits, for example, to the military capabilities and the spending capabilities of a country. That's a very rational idea. But if you want to elect one of those candidates in the primaries who's pushing that idea, you get to get a whole bunch of ideas that Americans aren't going to elect anybody who thinks that way. It comes in a package. And so that's why by the time Americans really have a choice between the nominee for the Democrats and the nominee for the Republicans, they're presented with people who are very mainstream when it comes to these big issues. And they actually have a word for it. They call it the bipartisan consensus on foreign policy when we talk about the U.S.'s role in the world. And yet, even with that, if you go look at President Obama's speeches that he gave while running for office in 2008 when he was just candidate Obama, or you go listen to President George W. Bush's campaign speeches when he's running for president the first time, both of those guys are promising a more realistic, less intrusive foreign policy. You remember George W. Bush called it compassionate conservatism and a more humble foreign policy. Then he gets into office and things change. Either he changes his mind or the conditions change. Same thing with Barack Obama. I always like to say that in the last election we had between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, I can think of a candidate that would have beat them both.
Well, let's say
Barack Obama from 2008.
Let me just inject this as far as I don't think there's any mystery as to why George Bush changed his mind. And I don't really think that it had that much to do with 9/11. I mean, 9/11 or not, he chose to staff his cabinet and his advisors with people who had this very aggressive attitude about what America's role in the world should be. And they had been around since the 70s. So those, I think, are more important forces, is that the people who exist in the shadows, and you can know who they are. I mean, especially in the information age of today. But, you know, Bush changed his foreign policy because of who was chosen to advise him, I think.
Well, but let's examine it a little bit more closely, because you're still making an assumption that Bush changed anything, or that Barack Obama changed anything. We don't know for a fact that that wasn't simply for public consumption,
which gets
me to my next point. It's kind of a chink in our national armor. It doesn't matter what a politician promises and whether or not Americans have a choice, right? So we said that a Mike Gravel or a Ron Paul could run for office and Americans would finally have a chance to choose whether or not they wanted the United States to be the policeman of the world. But we have no mechanism at all to hold those people to those promises. Just like President Bush and President Obama, neither one of them stuck to their promises. And there are no downsides to that except another election against another person from the complete opposite party that we know people are relatively tribal in terms of their adherence and the lesser of two evils idea. In other words, there's no real danger President Obama is going to lose a lot of votes in his second election based on the fact he didn't stick, and you mentioned this yourself, to many of the promises he made. If we're in a private contractual arrangement and you promise me something and you don't deliver, I have remedies. Mm-hmm. You're going to definitely feel pain for letting me down on your contractual obligations that you decided to jettison without my permission as the second contract holder. We don't have anything like that in politics. And as a matter of fact, the people who are the Sharpies and the consultants in politics, the James Carvilles, the Lee Atwaters, all these, the Karl Roves, these people consider campaign promises to be proverbially jokes. And everybody, I mean, you go to Washington, D.C. and you talk to these people, there's not even a pretense that that's what they are. Nobody feels bound by them. So what do we get when people promise us anything? It doesn't mean anything. They could either change their minds later and there's no sanction, or they could just be saying whatever it takes to win and there's no sanction. So that's a pretty huge flaw in our system.
Well, as somebody who, and I know, you know, on Common Sense, you talk a lot about solving these problems. And what you just said, I mean, doesn't that seem like a pretty insurmountable flaw where the government basically exists outside of the realm of consequences for dishonesty or wrongdoing? Like, how could that ever be remedied?
You know, you have to go back to the founding documents of the United States and the writings of the people who were designing the system to see how they thought all this would work. The one thing that always blows me away, just as a little digression here, when you read what they wrote is, you know, it's mythologizing to talk about the so-called founding fathers in reverential tones and all this kind of stuff. But it really is amazing when you read stuff like James Madison's writings and you realize the guy is in his mid-20s when he does this, and you can hardly follow his intelligent line of thinking even now. I mean, these are really incredible people. But they thought that there were mechanisms in place, including human nature, which is, I think, part of the wonder of their design is how much they built it with human nature in mind. And they figured that people would jealously guard power. And what they did was, as you know, separate the power into competing blocks, you know, different branches of government, for example. But what happens if all of a sudden people find it a good idea not to defend their power? Take, for example, this idea of how the power of Congress is broken down in things like the right to decide when this country goes to war. Americans almost can't remember. Most Americans were not alive the last time the United States declared war. But ostensibly, the only time we can actually go into a full-fledged war is with a declaration, and that declaration is a power that belongs to Congress. Congress hasn't used that power in so long that it has been de facto eliminated, and the founding fathers would be appalled at how this happened. It happened because Congress didn't want the power, which defies their idea of human nature. People don't deliberately give up power, especially people that have made it their lives work to achieve that power. But they didn't seem to realize, and you can go back to ancient Rome and see the parallels, something that the founding fathers studied intensely, by the way. In ancient Rome, it got to a point where you eventually had an emperor who was running what we now look back on as an empire, right, with complete authority. But what always blows people away when they study the Roman Empire is that people were still electing senators. And you say to yourself, well, why are people electing senators if you have an emperor with total and complete authority? Because people still wanted to be senators. And because you could still get all sorts of prestige by being a senator, and you could still do favors for people by being a senator, by going up to the emperor and saying, you know, Romulus Remus wants a deal for his company on the Adriatic and, you know, maybe get the ear of the emperor. In other words, it became useful for politicians to maintain the trappings of office. And by jettisoning the power, they were able to jettison the responsibility too. For example, if you decide you're going to declare war and President Bush wants to go to war with Iraq and the Congress has to actually declare war and it goes badly, all of a sudden those politicians that put their John Hancock on the war declaration are vulnerable, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they don't do that, they're not vulnerable. And they have the right to then claim that, yes, we supported it with a resolution, so I get full credit for how well that turned out, if it turns out well. Or, hey, I never declared war. I mean, I never thought my resolution meant we were going to do A, B, and C, and therefore avoid responsibility if it goes badly. but they still get to be senators or congressmen. They still get the perks. They still get the nice restaurant. They still get to run for re-election. In other words, all of these things that were seen as jealously guarded prerogatives of power that the Founding Fathers built into a system of competing power arrangements became too much trouble when you could have all the good parts and jettison all the bad parts by simply giving up the authority.
There's an interesting contradiction there, though, I think. What you're talking about, and I totally agree with, like, oh, yeah, if I don't have to have accountability for this stuff, great, because that means there's no record of my wrongdoing, and that means that I get reelected and maintain this power that I already have. Right. So I think this is just that they are still guarding power. Right. They just don't want that. They don't want to be exposed to that accountability that could cost them that power.
Well, but you could see how it was supposed to work when you look at, for example, the Congress the way it was in the 1980s when the Speaker of the House was a guy like Tip O'Neill. Mm-hmm. Tip O'Neill jealously guarded the prerogatives of the House of Representatives. And if the president tried to do something that he saw as a congressional power, he would scream and yell and tell, you know, as a powerful Speaker of the House could, all the members of the House that they needed to go and talk to the media. Your talking points are going to be about how the executive branch is usurping the constitutional authority of the Congress, blah, 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 and turn it into a national issue that did not go away until the executive branch, you know, either went in for negotiations or were knuckled under. I mean, I guess what I'm saying is we don't even have to look that far back to see when Congress was actually acting the way the Founding Fathers expected them to act, where they were jealously guarding actual powers, not the trappings of power.
Mm. So the kinds of people who are attracted to power, do you think that that is also one of the flaws in the system? Because it doesn't seem like power attracts good people generally and historically, right? So it's a lot of trust to put in power-seeking people.
Well, and again, to get back to the people who designed the Constitution, I think you can see some of that idealism in their hope, not assumption, but hope that you would get people who were trying to do something that was more of a civic responsibility rather than something that was a personal aggrandizement. But I think they built a system expecting the worst and understood that you were going to get those kind of people who were attracted to power. I think most of the founders lived long enough to see how wrong they were about that because the situation changed very quickly. By the time Andrew Jackson's president, you already have some of the people who designed the Constitution saying the whole thing was over. So that's how quickly some of them were willing to write it off. I think that if you want to look at it, I mean, I quoted in the last Common Sense show, a woman who was married to Ernest Hemingway for a while, a wonderful journalist in her own right named Martha Gellhorn, who used to write for the Atlantic magazine during the World War II era. And she famously wrote once that it doesn't matter what country you're in. If you meet generals and politicians, they're the same everywhere, that it's a certain kind of individual that's attracted to those roles. Mm. And it has nothing to do with a democracy. I mean, she says that the kind of politicians you could run into in socialist countries, even in fascist countries. You go to Nazi Germany, and we forget now because we think about it as a completely one-man ruled country. But they had a legislature. They had people who were actually at least in positions of authority. They may not have had any actual power, but they got all the perks too. And it attracted those same kind of people, whether they're eraser clapper types or the kind who want to be class president in the schools or whatever. Those kinds of individuals are a certain, you know, without generalizing too much, a certain kind of personality type. Does it represent everybody in government? No, of course not. But I'd be willing to say it represents 75% of them. I can always find people that I respect and like and think are doing the wonderful job of self-sacrifice for the greater, you know, public good. But I think they're outnumbered by the people who aren't, and they're outnumbered by the people who are more interested in having a senator or a congressman's title after their name or even president after their name than they are about public service and really improving things. But, you know, listen, the people who founded this country also were not naive enough to think their system would last forever. No system has lasted forever. And it might just be a historical truth that eventually all these systems lose momentum or begin to fray at the edges or begin to become so unbalanced that they just can never quite be put back into whack again. And one might make the case that something like that is underway now. There's no way to know how unbalanced we are, you know, how close we are as a spinning top that has started to wobble of falling. But I think everybody is starting to wake up to the fact that all is not well. I was talking about that in my old radio show in 1996, and people were saying, "You're crazy, Dan. Everything's just fine." So the good news is that now I have a lot more people agreeing with me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think that everybody has started to feel that, I think, especially on the conservative side, that something is changing. I think for a lot of them, it's really embodied in the in Obama, unfortunately.
Yeah, but I think you see it on the left, too. The Occupy Wall Street people, all these. I mean, I think you tend to see these things on the periphery of the political spectrum first, on both sides. And as it becomes more and more apparent and as it worsens, more and more people begin to notice it moving toward the center. President Obama gave a speech at Ohio State University to the graduating class the other day, and we talked about this in a Common Sense show we recently did too, where he told all those people not to listen to the voices out there that the government is, you know, on the road to tyranny or that any of these things are true. But the problem is he has to say that because more and more people are beginning to think that. You don't say that if a tiny little 1% fringe believes that. It becomes an issue presidents start talking about when they're beginning to worry about how many people are worried about that on the left and the right.
Yeah, I found that to be kind of a disturbing statement.
It's just fine to mention that. But you have to explain if this is a problem worth talking about. See, this is what it says to me. When you bring it up like that, you've decided it's a problem worth talking about it because you just talked about it. So what are you going to do about it? You know, what I would have liked to have seen from President Obama is, listen, those voices that say tyranny is something we should be worried about are wrong. And to make sure they're wrong, I'm implementing A, B, and C that will help people understand that we're pushing back towards these forces that scare people and worry them. Instead, he's doubling down on surveillance. So what are you supposed to make about that? Instead of maybe saying, you know, well, again, if I could have a time machine and go get candidate Obama from 2008 and bring him here and put him on television and play the speech that he just gave, I'm sure he'd have a wonderful critique of where the president is wrong. Mm. That's part of the problem.
Yeah. It seems like he's kind of been seduced or that he just got real about what this power actually means. And I did. I mean, I was never really a fan of his, but I definitely thought he was much more idealistic in the again, that is the campaign than he turned out to be. And I think maybe what was presented to him was some of the realities of, you know, what's going on and what this job is really all about.
And well, understand what these guys are like, right? These people do, and you know this, exquisite polling to find out what the American people want to hear. It's very interesting to go look at their campaign promises because their campaign promises represent what their exquisite polling has told them the American people want, what they're worried about, what sort of policies they'd like to see. So when George W. Bush campaigns on having a more humble foreign policy, when President Obama campaigns on essentially not being as interventionist, that's because they found out that's what we want to hear. Now, the fact that they change their minds or change their ideas when they're elected somehow shows what – well, you suggested one of the possibilities, that this is reality and they tell us what they need to do to get elected and then they govern us the way that we would govern ourselves if we were privy to all the insider info.
Right.
Or another possibility is that they get into power and then the entities you spoke of earlier – whether it's the giant banking cabals, whether it's, I mean, you name it, fill in the blank for whoever you consider to be the power brokers to be. Maybe they're the ones who then get to dictate. I mean, the fact that President Obama screams about needing to reform the financial system and then puts the people in the financial system in charge of the financial system should show us all that there's something wacky going on. There's a lot of reasons that might explain why they do that. But the part that should make us all feel kind of good is that when they're running for office, what they say represents what we want. And when they're running for office, they always say, they don't say, we're going to go intervene in more countries. We're going to send our troops to be the global policemen. People don't run on those platforms, which shows you what we, the people, want. Now, how we can turn those campaign promises into reality, that's a very good question when we start talking about reform. And somehow that has to come from the bottom up, because we see what happens when it comes from the top down. The presidents change their minds. So I don't know how we reinstitute the people with the power to hold our leaders accountable for the promises they make to us that get them elected.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I was very involved politically for a number of years. Right up until the time that I think I discovered your show, I was more left-leaning. I had been very influenced by people like Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky. And it was a number of things that just kind of led to my ultimate resignation from the idea that these problems, especially the ones that were created by politics or by government, were going to have political solutions. So it was exciting to see these new forms of resistance or these new groups, whether I disagreed with them or not, springing up, you know, on, I guess, what would be the fringes of the political spectrum. But really, I wound up being disappointed again when I saw that they thought that there was some political way to solve this. I don't see it, right? I think government pretty much exists in all of the structures that surround it to maintain the status quo to the people who are benefiting from it. And I don't know if it's ever been anything else. I know there's been some great idealistic thinkers who wanted it to be something else. But yeah, from my experience, I really have a hard time seeing it as anything else than a tool for the powerful to maintain a situation from which they can benefit.
I'm less pessimistic about that part of it, because I think, once again, to get back to what you started this conversation with, the idea of historical wild cards, I think historical wild cards happen. You take a look at a president that I'm not a big fan of, but I am of one aspect of what he did. Take a look at Teddy Roosevelt when he becomes president and then goes ahead and starts busting up the trusts and the monopolies that had developed as part of what's known as the Gilded Age in the United States. If he hadn't done that, we would be in a very different place than where we are now. And nobody could have predicted that a rich man like Theodore Roosevelt, who was known as a traitor to his class for what he did, would have gone and done that. And what he did was not something that the legislature favored either. It shows you the power one really committed person can do in the role of the presidency if they want to. I think those things are possible because of the wild card element that is human beings and human nature and all that. To me, the greater danger and the greater cause to be pessimistic is not a partisan question or anything. It's the question of the increasing complexity, right, of the accrued amount of baggage that our government has. If you decided tomorrow you want to come in and really reform the American system, look at how much you have to almost get rid of. You know, okay, think about it this way. Imagine we have a really cluttered closet, and that's the American legislative system. In order for you to go in there and really fix things, it seems to me, my own opinion, that you would literally have to go into that closet and start throwing out all the trash so you could get down to a point where there was enough room to start organizing things. That, to me, is the problem. We have, I mean, take, for example, a lot of this anti-terror stuff that many of us consider to be part of the problem. How could you ever go in and turn the clock back 30 years on anti-terrorism legislation? Even if you wanted to, it seems to me that it's almost too much. I compare it to one of those hoarding shows. We've become a people that hoard our legislative history to such a degree that you would have to have some outsider come in and literally force us while we're right, crying, to throw out legislation we don't need anymore and that we need to get rid of in order to streamline, reorganize, and revamp things for the 20th century. I mean,
right, right.
But even look at the drug war thing, where these states are voting for legalization of marijuana in their states. And you can hear people say at the federal level that even if the federal government wanted to say that's okay, we have since 1971 or something, treaties with other nations requiring them to adhere to these drug laws that we would be violating if we did so. So you've legislatively hamstrung yourself so much with past legislation that we can't give the people in these states what they want because it would violate all these old laws that, you know, you'd have to throw away first in order to then build a new drug policy on top of. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a big difference, too. I definitely get the comparison to hoarders. I think that paints a very, very good picture. But different than a closet filled with empty paper towel rolls, you know, legislation, each one of those pieces of legislation has a certain group of hangers-on, you know, people who are benefiting from the existence of that piece of legislation. So every little thing that you would try to cut or get rid of, and I mean, my as I became more libertarian, this was a real headache, especially through a lot of my realizations about the government school system, is that you can't reform it. There is nothing that could be done from where we are. And I mean, ultimately, my solution, long story short, just was, hey, parents, you know, look for other options. Try to just steer clear of this altogether if you can. But government is very good at creating dependence. I think this goes back to what we were going to talk about with the emergence of Nazi Germany. Prior to the Weimar Republic, under what was his name? Wilhelm? When he's setting up
that, the Weimar Republic, you're thinking of people like Franz von Papen and stuff like that. Before Weimar was the Kaiserreich under the Kaiser.
Yeah, under Kaiser Wilhelm. So even before the Weimar Republic, you have this emergence in Central Europe of this Social Democratic Party and people in power kind of threatened by the popular appeal of that kind of government and Wilhelm saying, well, let's just beat them at their own game and socialize all these services. And you have this huge welfare state happening there at the turn of the 20th century. And I think that dependence, and you can see it in other places as well, but that dependence increased the government's power so much. And I say this to when people talk about how well socialism is working in like Scandinavia, those countries are revolution proof or even really dissent proof, I think, to a certain degree, because so many people are so dependent on the system. So that ties to the conversation about legislation is that nobody's going to let go of anything because as soon as something goes into place, there is this herd of beneficiaries that kind of run to it and cling on to it.
Well, I think we've strayed into a little bit of a different territory because I would make the case, one, that Germany wasn't that socialistic. And I would also make the case that if you look at the Scandinavian countries, I think the test there is to ask the Scandinavians if they're happy. And that's what I think changes the equation. You can talk about a beneficiary class if you want to, but if people are happy with their system, I'm not sure they shouldn't get what they want.
Well, let's say we do that poll.
Although one could make the case that, you know, if you ask people living in Nazi Germany if they were happy with their system and if they said yes, I'm not sure they should get what they want either. So maybe that works both ways.
Yeah, but let's do a poll. I think that it's a little skewed if you go to a country like Sweden and 25% of the people in the poll work for the government and 45% of the people in the poll are receiving some kind of significant benefit from the government. And it would probably be certainly higher than that. Then, that comes out on the favor of people are happy with the government. But then I think there's other questions about sustainability. Obviously, economically, we've seen a lot of these problems come to in places like Greece. But I get what you're saying. But I think that those polls would skew towards, yes, very happy with government. First of all,
well, look at healthcare. I mean, always find healthcare I've changed my mind on healthcare over the years. I think healthcare is a perfect example. I am unable to find a country that has government health care where the people would ever get rid of it. Now, is that a case of people being dependent on government so that, they're a captive audience? And so, or is that a case of people saying, well, wait a minute, we like this. We would not want to go back to what we had before it. See, the argument that libertarians always propose, and I think it's a logical one, is that those things come at the expense of people having money taken away from them to pay for other people's needs.
Mm-hmm.
The question then, you know, happens on an individual level. Is that fair to do to person A to pay for person B's health care? And what kind of a system do you end up afterwards? I would make the argument that in a system like ours, where we try to fight that sort of trend, and you know, we don't have that kind of healthcare because you know, we'll often say that we don't want to do that. You know, it used to be we were a low tax and low service society, and a place like Sweden was a high tax and a high service society. And yet, due to things like military commitments, past wars, and all sorts of other things, we've become a relatively low service system, but our taxes are creeping up to what the high service systems charge. In that case, it becomes a question of what sort of value, if you can't control how much money you pay, if you're going to pay a 35 to 45% tax rate no matter what you do, then it becomes a question of are you getting what you pay for? If you have no choice over paying, what are you getting? And the people in these Scandinavian societies are getting totally free health care. Mm. They're getting education at much better levels than we are. They're getting a society that's clean, an infrastructure that runs. And yes, they're paying higher taxes than we are, but not that much higher anymore. And ours are creeping up. So maybe that ship has sailed, but you don't see a whole lot of low tax, low service societies anymore, especially not ones that most people in the first world, so-called first world, would want to live in.
Well, I think it's also, I don't know if you know this or not, but when the Canadian National Healthcare Program was instituted in that country decades ago, there was a lot of protest. I agree that if you go to Canada today and ask the average person there, would you get rid of the system, that they would say no. I mean, I have anecdotes. I certainly know of one Canadian right now who would like to see the system go. I know of people in Britain who would like to see their system go. But those are more anecdotes. And I would agree that with what you're saying, that there are perhaps even a majority of people who would say, no, I want this system to exist.
Oh, Brett, the polls are not majority. They're overwhelming.
I'll grant you that.
Overwhelming,
sure.
In the 85% range.
But remember, what do you think the attitude is in America towards public education, which was also fought by a lot of people who thought that this was a dangerous service to turn over to the control of the government in the late 1800s? So I think one of the libertarian positions.
But here's the difference, Brett. I agree with you that if you said to people, are you happy with the public school system? Mm-hmm. I bet you would get a ton of people who said no.
Today,
if you said,
yeah,
should we do away with public education,
I think
you would get a huge number of people that said no to that, though, too.
Right.
So you get this dichotomy where they're not happy with what they have. But if you propose an alternative that gets rid of what they have, they don't want that either.
Well, that's the thing. And that speaks to the dependence part of it, too, because I've had this conversation with tons. I mean, I've done a pretty good sample size on this myself in my own career. Are you happy with your child or your adolescent's public school experience? Absolutely not. Would you like to see the system go away? No, that's absolutely insane. What are you even talking about? Who would watch them during the day when I'm at work?
You're drawing the wrong conclusion if you assume that that's because of dependency. It's the same as saying, are you happy with your government right now? And saying, no, I'm not happy with your government. Well, would you like the American Republic to transform into a different system? No, I just want it to work like it's supposed to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the reality you're hearing here. Even when you hear, for example, from a Briton who's not happy with the National Health Service, it's not that they want the National Health Service to go away. They want it to run better. And that's a very human thing. But that's not so much dependency as it is, you know, you're looking at something and you say, well, why the heck did I have to fill out 900 forms to get that operation? I shouldn't have to do that. That's not the same as saying I don't want a system where, you know, I get free health care. So, I mean, I think it's natural to say the system isn't running like it should, but not want to get rid of the system.
But unfortunately, too, I think that is a bureaucracy working the way that it's supposed to. It's not the way that politicians on the campaign trail talk about it working, but that's pretty much how bureaucracies work. And there's very few examples that would suggest otherwise. And do you think I'm being too cynical if I say that the American schooling system works very well? There's plenty of beneficiaries. It corrals people ideologically into what I think is a safe range of thinking as people like people who've been in the system, like John Taylor Gatto has suggested, that it deals with dissidents in a very proactive way, by making it not even a consideration. So I think
those things worry me a lot less than the Leviathan side of what's happened to public education and its inability to innovate because it's become so calcified. But in my opinion, it's just a reflection of the rest of government. It's not that government is inefficient because government is inefficient. It's inefficient because over time it's become calcified, weighed down, and that these are, you know, when you bring up bureaucracy, I think people can make the case that bureaucracies in some stage of their development can often be quite efficient. The danger is that over time they calcify, they get weighed down, and they lose the ability to become nimble, innovate, and change. When that happens, it's a little like a human mind, if you want to make the same comparison. When we're young, sometimes you can be flexible. You can change ideas quite quickly. When you become older, you become more set in your ways. It becomes more difficult to pivot, to learn new technology, to change. In that sense, I think human institutions are maybe just following human beings themselves. And so am I happy with the school system? I'm absolutely not. But I think that what you do with the school system to fix it is very similar to cleaning out the hoarder closet of old legislation. I mean, nothing upsets me more than to have the war on terror happen and to be able to have the government look back to 1917 for an sedition act
right.
that they can then pull up and apply again, when that act should have been gone a long time ago. The schools are in a similar bind. I mean, we have an organization that was designed more than 100 years ago for a very different America. And what should have happened? I mean, listen, if you look at European schools, and I'm not pretending that they are the end-all be-all, or the Japanese schools, same thing, not pretending they're the end-all be-all, but they've done a much better job of staying current than we have. Now, there are all sorts of reasons people will point to, everything from public employee unions to, cabinet-level education positions. I mean, you can go down the list. But the fact remains that the farther behind you get in terms of your evolution, the harder it is to get back up to full capacity. Because now, instead of needing to make minor tweaks to get to full capacity, you have to make major revolutionary changes. And right. That, to me, is the bigger issue, is that it's become a leviathan that's way behind where it needs to be, and yet it's unrealistic to expect something like what we have to be able to change as much as it needs to change now. That's the problem in my mind. It's not so much ideology, even though it's there, and it's not so much a certain outlook that's required and that's taught to teachers in Department of Education courses, even though that's there. To me, the bigger issue has to do with simply the size and the inability to innovate.
Are you familiar with John Taylor Gatto?
Vaguely.
Vaguely?
Yeah, I would not be comfortable debating his ideas.
No, I would just leave on that note. He wrote this great book that goes to all kinds of dark and spooky places. It's called The Underground History of American Education. If you don't know his story, I think he taught in public schools in New York for about 30 years. His career concluded with him winning the Teacher of the Year award. And then he did this very public resignation where he said, I think he said a lot of things that you would agree with. You know, as this job exists now, I am not a teacher, and what I'm doing is not education.
Listen, it's scary enough if you just go back and read the things that people like Dewey were talking about
yeah.
in designing this education system. There's no question that, you know, it's designed for an age where conformity is wanted, that people are to be educated for a workforce where they're basically drones. I mean, sure, all that stuff is at the root of the modern American system. The hope is that you have a system that can grow and evolve and maintain enough flexibility to change with the times. If that were the case, you wouldn't still be able to trace a direct line of development from Dewey's ideas to where we are now.
Yeah.
Somewhere down the road, it would have taken a 90-degree turn like the 9/11 attacks forced our government to do, and we would move in a completely different direction. The fact that that hasn't happened, in my mind, is a sign of how calcified the thing has become.
And one trend that I saw, and this actually helped inform much of what my current position is today, is that as the system developed, you acknowledge that with Dewey in the beginning, but these different interest groups tried to latch onto it. Horace Mann had this religious intention, and then people who were afraid of immigrants. One group in Oregon, in your state, in the 1920s was the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
To see that as the system progressed, different interest groups were always trying to grab the reins of it to push a message or an ideology that they found favorable for the country at large. I mean, of course, that's another problem with the system that you've acknowledged on your show, is that it has to try to be all things to all people. But there's people who recognize that it's all things to all people educationally, and they want to control it for their own ends. And I think that groups have tried that with varying levels of success. And that is definitely something that I encourage people to take a closer look at. But
see, this is why, I mean, I've always been in favor of the idea of creating all sorts of schools that are privately run. Mm-hmm. So in other words, parents would have the choice of where to put their children based on, you know, let's say you want a religious education. I know libertarians will go absolutely ballistic when they hear this, but let's say you want God in your classroom. Well, okay. Don't weigh the public school system down with all these fights over whether or not you can say a school prayer or not. Just let parents who want that sort of thing able to choose a school that gives it to them. But here's where I would maintain the public school system. I would fund those schools out of tax dollars so that they're still public schools, but there's not a public school system of the Leviathan sort that we have today. So, in other words, theoretically, you would free all these individual schools up to innovate, but people still would have a system funded by taxpayers for the good of the society as a whole. Now, some people say, I don't want my tax dollars going to a school where people pray, but that's what funds a school that allows you to send your kid to one that is more in line with what you think and feel and want your kid educated in.
So more like a voucher system.
Yes, like a voucher system.
Yeah, and there's lots of, I mean, that's something that I've been critical of in the past, but I definitely understand that there's positive aspects to that. The problem is suddenly you find yourself back in the closet full of junk fighting the teachers union who says, and I hate to be such a cynic, Dan, I tell you on my show, I am more optimistic than I sound right now about a lot of this stuff, but you wind up fighting the teachers union who says, well, if this is public money, you know, that's going to these schools, certainly they need to meet the same rigorous standards that our union members meet. So the unions or all the educators in the private system could wind up being subsumed by the union, too.
Well, but see, now you're going to drag me into other areas that will get me in trouble.
Sorry.
But see, here's a weird dichotomy about me, and it would require 2 hours of explanation. So your listeners will have to take my word for it.
Okay.
But I am a pro-labor individual. But I don't believe there should be public employee unions.
Yeah,
because one, there's all sorts of inbred problems with that, where the politicians and the unions are really on the same side of so many things. And two, you know, unions are supposed to provide leverage for workers against management. But when the taxpayers are the management, then the unions are providing leverage against the taxpayers. And I don't think that's right. And I think the fact that you see public employee unions as basically the only strong unions left in America is a sign of how they sort of have special advantages in the system. I mean, here in Oregon, for example, the politicians are on the same public employee retirement system that the public employees are on. So whenever that issue comes up and we start talking about reforming the public employee unions in the state of Oregon, the legislators who will vote on that are also part of that system. And to make matters worse, the judges that will rule on the constitutionality of that system are also on that system. So this is not right. No matter what you're feeling about unions or even public employee unions, that is an incestuous system that is unable to think clearly about these things because they all are vested interests in and of themselves. And so when you bring up teachers' unions, to me, part of the inflexibility of our system to innovate the way we have to innovate is because some of these innovations we need might not be good for teachers. They might be good for students at the expense of teachers. And let's be honest, a union's job is to look out for their dues-paying members. That's right. Exactly what they should do as well. But if we need to choose, and I know they reject this idea, but if we need to choose between ideas that hurt our teachers in order to help our school system and our children, those unions are going to be against those ideas, and they're going to push ideas that they believe will be good for both. I'm just not a believer that we're at a point where that sort of inflexibility is something we can live with, because we can't get any significant reform movement at all. And so, I mean, in general, though, I'm not in favor of police officers, of firemen, of any of these people being able to unionize. And it's not because I'm anti-labor, because I'm very pro-labor. It's because of the inherent contradictions in being a public employee on one hand and being a union member on the other.
It's leverage against who their management is supposed
That's
to
right.
be.
That's right. It's kind of, I mean, it's a very different animal than a private employee union.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So how about this? Let's conclude in agreement on that.
Absolutely. I've enjoyed your questions. I've enjoyed the topics of conversation.
Well, that's great. If we had 5 hours, I don't feel like it would have been enough time. I felt like we could have filled it all. And I hope you'll consider coming back in the future.
Listen, the biggest compliment you could have given me is that we just talked all this time and I didn't bore your pants off. So.
No. Oh, Dan, I would keep we're about 45 minutes away from going live on Ustream here to do a call-in show. If that was not in the way and you had no scheduling conflicts, I would go for hours and hours. This is terrific.
So Dan Carlin until he bores you, huh?
Well, I mean, I've been listening.
It's always good to leave him wanting more, right?
Absolutely. So I hope you'll consider coming back in the future. Can you give us your websites and how people can learn more about your work?
Well, it's easy to remember my website. It's just dancarlin.com. If you use iTunes, you can just go to the search bar in iTunes, type my name in, Dan Carlin with a C, and you'll see everything we do. You'll see both our podcasts. You'll see we just recently managed to get our old history shows put up where you could buy them for $1.99 if you've already listened to all the free ones on our website. And, you know, sample them. They're not for everybody. We always say that. Some people can't even deal with the sound of my voice. I understand that. My wife feels the same way. But we'd love it if you go over to the website, take a look around and see if it's something you can deal with.
Excellent. And I highly, highly recommend it. Like I said at the beginning, Dan was a very influential podcaster in my development, and I've always enjoyed both shows. And it was a real pleasure to have you on. So thanks again.
Well, that's a big compliment. Thank you so much for having me.